This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
It is Sunday, May 5th, 2024, and this is hour one of the Sunday Cincinnati Inquirer. I'm Jonathan. We'll start off with today's headline. New mayor tries to de-escalate Confederate flag controversy. That is not who I am. Dan Horn, Cincinnati Inquirer, USA Today Network. Harrison, Ohio. Ryan Grubb's phone started ringing a few days after Christmas, while he stood in his kitchen making chicken soup for his sick wife. Grubbs, who was less than a week away from being sworn in as the mayor of Harrison, often got calls at home about city business. But on this day, they kept coming. Friends, colleagues, neighbors, everyone wanted an answer to the same question. Why did he put a Confederate flag in the middle of town? Grubbs didn't know what they were talking about. He didn't put on a Confederate flag anywhere. When a friend texted him a photo, and there it was, one of the most divisive symbols in America, fluttering in the breeze above an official-looking sign that read, "Welcome to Harrison, Ohio." Right below those words in slightly small print was his name and a new title, Mayor Ryan Grubbs. The display sat on a privately owned field next to a church on Harrison Avenue, one of the city's busiest roads. Anyone passing through could see it. As he answered call after call in his kitchen that day, Grubbs grew frustrated. Without warning, someone had hijacked his name and reputation, tying him to a flag millions of Americans consider a symbol of white supremacy. "I do not like being associated with the flag," he said. "That is not who I am." In the days and weeks that followed, two more displays of Confederate flags and signs went up at two other locations in Harrison, a city of 13,000 about 20 miles west of Cincinnati. TV news crews arrived. Social media overflowed with photos and speculation. Soon, more people got caught up in the chaos. A black teenager who could see one of the displays from her front porch said the flag made her uncomfortable in her own neighborhood. The owners of an auto repair shop across the street from a flag said it tarnished their names and businesses. A business councilman who spoke out against the displays got arrested on charges of vandalizing one of them. Not everyone in Harrison shared their concerns about the flag. Some said it was just a piece of cloth, an old symbol of rebellion or Southern pride, a relic with no real power or meaning. But for Grubbs and others whose lives were upended by the flag's arrival, it was something more. If the flag had no power or meaning, they said, people wouldn't still be flying it, in Harrison or anywhere else. "It may just be a flag to some people," Grubb said, "but it's not to others." A new mayor tries to clear his name. Grubb's first week as mayor did not go the way he would have liked. Instead of easing into the job with meetings about road projects and budgets, he spent days talking about Confederate flags. Grubbs had lived most of his 49 years in Harrison, leaving for college and missionary work with his church. He and his wife, Andy, raised four children in the city, and he'd served for a decade as a Republican member of city council. Yet the only thing many Harrison residents knew about Grubbs in early January was that the new mayor's name was attached to those flags. Harrison is about 45% white, according to the U.S. Census, and it wasn't hard for Grubbs to imagine why. Black residents, in particular, might be concerned if they believed their city government and mayor endorsed the Confederate flag. So Grubbs set out to assure them, and everyone else, that it wasn't the case. He tried to return every call and answer every email. He promised again and again that the flags didn't represent him or the city. His toughest conversation came that first day the flags went up. when he called one of his daughter's friends, who is black. He worried she or her family might see the flags and signs before he could explain. If anyone wants to talk, he told her, I am here to talk. He knew, though, that talking could only get him so far. Grubbs wanted to find out who put up the displays and what, if anything, the city could do about them. He soon learned that Steve Hickey, a longtime Harrison resident, owned the three properties where the flags were flying, two rental homes and the empty field on Harrison Avenue. Hickey, a former Harrison police officer, had a bumpy history with the city government. His police personnel file shows he resigned in April 2004, but media reports at the time said he had been suspended before he resigned for allegedly interfering with a sheriff's investigation of his brother in Dearborn County, Indiana. The Dearborn County Register reported in 2004 that a disciplinary hearing determined Hickey violated 21 department rules and behaved as if he had a score to settle. But that was 20 years ago. No one seems to know for certain what Hickey was up to now. If the flags were some kind of protest, what was he protesting? Grubbs said he tried several times to find out. He said he'd sent Hickey emails and left voicemail messages, but got no response. Hickey also did not respond to multiple attempts by the Inquirer to reach him on his cell and work phones and at the properties displaying the flags. I just wanted to have a conversation with the guy, Grubbs said. About a month later in February, Hickey added about a dozen toilets to the largest flag display on Harrison Avenue. He arranged them like chairs around the base of the flagpole. Handwritten signs on some toilets said Mayor and Council, but Hickey offered no other explanation. City officials, however, had a way to fight back this time. While the First Amendment protected Hickey's right to put up the flags and signs on his property, the toilets violated zoning codes and would have to go. Before they did, Hickey finally broke his silence, saying in a TV interview he wanted the city to clean up an auto repair shop across the street from one of his rental properties. The flags and toilets were his way of protesting the city's lack of action, Hickey said. He also said he didn't understand why some people were making such a fuss about the Confederate flag. I don't know why society has become offended by everything, Hickey said. They're offended by the air they breathe nowadays. A young neighbor confronts the flag history. Harrison is home to fewer than 200 black residents, according to the census. Ania Duro is one of them. The 15-year-old high school sophomore said she didn't think much about the flags when they went up, even when one appeared in her neighbor's front yard. She preferred hanging out at home or working on her latest art project to keeping up with the news from around town. Soon, though, she couldn't avoid the subject. The flag at her neighbor's house on Harrison Avenue was smaller than the main display in the heart of the city, but it was also hard to miss. Her neighborhood began showing up on TV news and social media. Kalani's mom, Martha Duro, decided to talk to Kalani about it. She told her about the flag's history, about its connection to slavery and the Civil War, and about the debate over its meaning. After that, Kalani said, I felt very uncomfortable. It wasn't the first time she felt that way since moving to Harrison with the Duro family as a foster child 5 years ago. Kayani said she's aware wherever she goes that she doesn't look like most people in Harrison. Her parents and siblings are white. Most of her neighbors, classmates, teachers are white. Usually, she said, that's fine, but not always. Her mom said Kayani's skin color makes her an easy target. There have been cruel remarks from other kids. And 2 years ago, while walking in a park, Kayani said that a man shouted a racist epithet at her. Since then, she rarely goes out alone. Kiani said she loves her family in her home, but the world beyond her front porch can be a challenge in ways it isn't for other teenagers in Harrison. I just don't fit in, she said. Upset about the flag, Kalani's mom said she asked her neighbor, Tim Ward, why it was there. Ward, who rents the property from Hickey, declined to talk to the Inquirer, but Duro said that he told her the flag was a symbol of a rebellion. She replied that it means something else to a black child she's raising two doors down. Everyone can say it's not about racism, but that doesn't make it feel safer, she said. I feel like this is sparking a lot of hate in the community, and I wish my family didn't have to be a part of it. Not long after her conversation with her neighbor, Duro bought a rainbow-colored flag with world peace spelled out in big letters across the center. Now it hangs from her porch. A business next door fights the flag. Down the street from Kalani's house, on the opposite side of the yard with a Confederate flag, sits Hilltop Performance Off-Road, the truck and Jeep shop that Hickey said prompted his flag protest. A sign attached to the flagpole proclaims, "Harrison zoning allows junkyards." Ethan and Ann Efkman, the couple who owned the shop for more than a decade, said they never met Hickey. They said Ward, their neighbor, was an occasional customer who often spent time hanging out at the shop with the staff. Ann said that they got to know him so well that she used to send him Christmas cards. She said neither Ward nor Hickey ever raised concerns to them about their business. But late last year, a city inspector said he'd received a complaint about street parking and the dozen or so vehicles that were typically parked around the shop's lot. When the inspector found no violations, that seemed to be the end of it. Then, weeks later, Ethan arrived at work one morning to find the flag flying next door. "It's horribly offensive," Ann Ekman said. "We think it's disgusting." She said the complaint about their business was one thing, but connecting their business to a symbol as divisive as the Confederate flag was shocking. Now, she said, that the connection people make if they do a Google search for Hilltop Performance. "This has really taken a toll on us," Efman said. Hickey has since lodged additional complaints against Hilltop with the Harrison Fire Department and the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency. Both found no problems. The Efmans said that they sent a cease and desist letter to Hickey, warning him to stop making accusations he can't back up. Ann Efman said she's not sure her family's business is the real reason behind Hickey's flag protest. Some in Harrison believe the root of the problem is a long-running zoning dispute that may have limited Hickey's ability to develop his property. Whatever the reason, Efman said, it's a mystery to her what the Confederate flags have to do with any of Hickey's complaints. "There are plenty of ways to resolve a disagreement," she said, "and flying those flags doesn't seem like one." "If you're mad," she said, "deal with it in other ways that aren't harmful to other people." She said a conversation months ago would have saved everyone a lot of grief. If that happened, Efman said, she and her husband would have explained they're building a new location for their business elsewhere in Harrison. "The shop next to Hickey's property will close by the end of the year," she said. "And the Confederate flag, if it's still there, will be flying next to an empty lot." A councilman's meeting, then an arrest. Harrison City Councilman Mike Maines said a conversation was all he wanted when he reached out to Hickey and Ward in January to talk about the flags. After a few weeks, Maine said, Hickey agreed to meet about them. By then, it was mid-February, and Hickey was about to add another larger sign to the main display. The new sign said, "Coming soon, City of Harrison's Homeless Camp." No one knew for certain what that meant, but the flags and signs and toilets were the talk of the town. I feel like I'm living in an episode of South Park, one commuter wrote on a community Facebook post. This just gets dumber and dumber by the day. Maines, a mechanical engineer who grew up in Harrison and raised four children in the city, said he wanted to meet Hickey in hopes of convincing him to take down the flags. As a libertarian, Maine said, he knows Hickey has a constitutional right to fly the flags, but he believes they reflect poorly on Harrison. We're not very diverse, but we're not a racist community, Maine said. We're good people, we're generous people, we love our neighbors. He said the flags also belie Harrison's history and the role in the Civil War. Young men from Harrison fought for the Union, and in 1863, the city was a crossing point for Confederate raiders under the command of General John Hunt Morgan. Back then, the flag was carried by the enemy. When they finally met, Maine said, Hickey complained to him about Hilltop performance and, more generally, about city officials. He said he urged Hickey to talk to the mayor and other city officials about his concerns, but Hickey declined. It's just frustrating, Maine said. I don't understand why he just won't sit down and have a conversation with people. According to police reports, the relationship between Maines and Hickey deteriorated in the weeks that followed their meeting. On March 31st, police said Hickey called to report that Maines drove his car onto his property, put up a libertarian yard sign, and damaged the large display on Harrison Avenue. Hickey also blamed Maines for removing some lights that had been shining on the flagpole at the bottom at one of the locations, and police said they observed a brown substance on other lights that appeared to be fecal matter. Police said Hickey gave them a recording of a conversation he had with Maines in which he asked Maines why he drove onto his property. "Because I'm pissed off," Maines replied. Maines, who was charged with misdemeanor counts of trespassing and criminal damage, responded to questions about charges in a written statement. "The city of Harrison has been bullied for months now by a man who seeks to sow division in our community," he said. "I stood up to that bully and unfortunately placed myself in a position where the criminal justice system could be weaponized against me." Maine's fellow council members asked him to resign in April, but he told them he's staying. "It's been a three-ring circus," he said. A few weeks after Maine's arrest, the Confederate flag near Kalani's house in Hilltop Performance came down. No one was sure at the time who had done it or why, but for several days, no flags flew in the yard. Less than a week later, a new, taller flagpole went up in the same yard. A few days after that, a newer, larger Confederate flag appeared atop of the pole. And that concludes the first headline article for today. Next we have, Keating returns to beloved flying pig. Local runner grateful after scare with heart. Shelby Dermer, Cincinnati Inquirer, USA Today Network. 6 months after completing a grueling 100-mile race in over 26 hours, nurses told Caroline Keating she was an inspiration. From her spot in a hospital bed at Cleveland Clinic, Keating hardly felt like a beacon of motivation. In 2022, Keating, a St. Ursula Academy graduate, was running 80 miles every week. A few months later, she was told she couldn't exercise after severe heart problems. During the 2022 Kroger Heart Mini Marathon, she experienced dizziness. Her vision blacked out and her heart rate spiked. The same thing happened in Boston a few weeks later, and then again in the Flying Pig Marathon, when she knew something was seriously wrong. 2 years removed from this experience, she'll toe the marathon line on Sunday in her first Flying Pig since her world changed. You don't realize how important your health is until it's taken away from you, she said. More serious than they thought. Keating believed low iron and dehydration caused her symptoms while running. Her primary care physician sent her to a cardiologist who supplied a heart rate monitor that doctors could watch. One afternoon, Keating jogged with friends at a light, conversational pace. An hour later, doctors called to explain that her heart rate was over 230 beats per minute. An ablation at the Christ Hospital revealed electrical issues in Keating's heart. She was going into ventricular tachycardia, the second deadliest heart rhythm you could go into. More serious than they thought, Keating said. They didn't know what was causing it. I was putting on a brave face. Keating has never lacked a competitive drive. That can be traced back to hula hoop competitions with her father, William. She was later an All-American swimmer at Bowling Green University, and the same spirit followed her into her running. Running became a big part of my life, she said. The competitive side of me was the hardest. The sport fueled her ambition as a 23-time marathon finisher. It was also her social circle, an outlet from the stress of daily life. One spring afternoon, it was stripped away from her in an instant when doctors told her to completely eliminate exercise. Friends called her lucky that she was able to identify a serious health concern. She was, but with a giant portion of her world taken away, it was hard to feel fortunate. I thought, am I lucky? I just want to be running right now. I was putting on a brave face, Keating said. The way back. The electrical issues in Keating's heart were fixed with surgery at Cleveland Clinic. Though the exploratory ablation was successful, the cause was still unknown. She was given a defibrillator in March of 2023, as ventricular tachycardia can come back worse than it did before. She was finally cleared by a doctor at Vanderbilt University just over a year ago to start running after 8 months on the sidelines. There's a mental hurdle to running again, blocking out the possibility of another dizziness spell or elevated heart rate. Still, it didn't stop Keating from making a swift return. When she was cleared in Nashville, she drove home, tossed a leash on her dog, and took off. However, the fitness element of 8 months off limited that jog to just half a mile. I was so out of shape, Keating laughed. That was good for day one. New goals. Keating sought inspiration from several sources. She had a great support system in her friends who encouraged her comeback. She also followed the journey of Kara Goucher, a long-distance runner and former Olympian who, in 2021, began suffering from dystonia, a neurological disorder that limits sensation in her right leg. Athletes can be their own worst enemy. Keating used Goucher's story to help take a step back. She, Goucher, said something to the effect of, "It's okay to not be the former version of yourself. Once you're able to let that go, you realize how much fun you're still able to have," Keating said. Keating's expecting her time on Sunday to be north of 30 minutes longer than what it would typically be for a half marathon. "And that's okay," she said. "It's hard for athletes to completely extinguish their competitive flames." Keating still has ambitions to qualify for the Boston Marathon again and beat her late father's family marathon record time of 3 hours 17 minutes, a mark she's previously missed by 7 minutes. That's not what Sunday will be about, though. Keating is ready to conquer the race that altered her life just 2 years ago. She'll retrace her footsteps from that fateful day across the finish line with no worries of the clock, only a celebration of the weight that's been lifted. I'm excited to get back to the race that I love. And that concludes that article. Moving on to your forecast. Today will primarily be dry, but there will be a few showers and rumbles of thunder around the area. We will see an afternoon high temps in the upper 70s to 80 degrees. The upcoming week will feature a chance of showers and thunderstorms each day, with high temperatures remaining above normal. Now we have the local buzz. Kings Island among best for theme park entertainment in U.S. Under the Stars at Kings Island ranked number 5 for the best theme park entertainment in America by USA Today's 10 Best Reader's Choice Awards. The Mason Amusement Park fireworks, drone and laser production show topped other attractions at Disney World, Magic Kingdom, Animal Kingdom, Universal Studios, and Epcot. Celtic Fry at Busch Gardens, Williamsburg, and Williamsburg, Virginia finished in number 1 spot overall. Selections for USA Today's 10 Best Rankings are nominated by a panel of industry experts vetted by 10 best editors and then voted on by the public. Cincinnati has won in several 10 best categories this year, including Best Street Art, Botanical Garden, Marathon, and Riverwalk. Here are the 10 finalists for Best Theme Park Entertainment. 1. Celtic Fry at Busch Gardens, Williamsburg, Williamsburg, Virginia. Rivertown Ramblers at Silver Dollar City in Branson, Missouri. Retrospect at Carowinds in Charlotte, North Carolina. Turn It Up Remix at Busch Gardens, Tampa Bay, Florida. Under the Stars at Kings Island, Mason, Ohio. Happier Ever After at Magic Kingdom, Orlando. Festival of the Lion King at Disney's Animal Kingdom, Orlando. The Burn Stuntacular at Universal Studios, Orlando. Indiana Jones Epic Stunt Spectacular, Orlando. And finally, in 10th place, Luminous the Symphony of Us at Epcot in Orlando. Next for you, we have Today in History. Today is May the 5th. On this day in 1821, Napoleon Bonaparte died in exile on the island of St. Helena. 1862. Outnumbered Mexican forces rebelled French troops at the Battle of Puebla. The victory gave rise to the celebration of Cinco de Mayo. 1877. To avoid the U.S. Army, Lakota leader Sitting Bull led his people from their homeland in Montana into Canada, where they lived for 4 years before returning to surrender. 1891. Carnegie Hall in New York, then known as Music Hall, opened with a concert. The performance was at first conducted by Walter Damrosch, director of the New York Symphony Orchestra, but after intermission was conducted by Pyotr Tchaikovsky. 1945. During World War II, the lone fatal attack involving Japan's balloon bomb killed 6 people in Oregon. 1955. The United States, France, and England ended their occupation of West Germany, which became a sovereign state and was allowed to rebuild its army. 1961. Alan Shepard became the first American to travel to space. The suborbital flight of the Freedom 7 spacecraft lasted for 15 minutes. And finally, in 1987, televised congressional hearings investigated the Iran-Contra affair, in which proceeds from the illegal sale of weapons to Iran were used to fund rebels in Nicaragua. The next section we have for you is Queen City Crime. Details of scandalous Hicks Snook murder trial lives on in UC Library. Amber Hunt, Cincinnati Inquirer, USA Today Network. The Hook, tucked inside a seemingly typical-looking library on the University of Cincinnati campus, is a small, tattered booklet containing transcripts of one of Ohio's most salacious 20th century trials. Between its faded covers is a tale of an illicit affair, tawdry sex, and the downfall of the Olympic competitor. It's titled The Murder of Thera Hicks and Trial of Dr. James H. Snook. And back when it was hot off the presses in 1929, it was a bestseller on the streets of Columbus, Ohio, where the shocking trial took place and beyond. Today, it resides in UC's Archives and Rare Books Library, an appointment-only section of the Blegen Library. The people, James Snook was a revered professor of veterinary medicine at Ohio State University with an Olympic past. He'd competed as a member of the U.S. Olympics pistol team. Yes, that's still a thing. Winning a gold medal in the men's 30-meter team military pistol event in the 1920 Olympics in Belgium. After his gold, Snook continued to be a pistoler as a hobby but focused his career on veterinary medicine, even inventing tools for his trade, including his most famous, a small surgical device to help in neutering and spaying of dogs and cats. The device, called a Snook hook, is still used today. He was a married father in his early 40s when he met Thera Hicks, a co-ed enrolled at the university. She was the daughter of Melvin Hicks, a school principal and textbook author, and Joanna, a homemaker who viewed her daughter as a gift from God when, after years of not being able to conceive a child, she welcomed her first and only baby at the age of 41. Teddy, as Thera was nicknamed, was an exceptionally bright student who flew through an undergrad at Ohio State before entering its College of Medicine. She met Snook not by taking one of his classes, but rather by joining a paid stenography pool to make extra money. Because Snook wrote a lot, he often tapped in stenography pool to take notes and dictation. Soon, Hicks caught his eye. The relationship. One rainy day, Snook spotted Hicks and a friend of hers walking outside, so he offered the duo a ride. A week later, he offered Hicks alone a ride in the country. They seemed an unlikely pair. Snook was buttoned up, staid STEAM professor, while Hicks was more outspoken and ahead of her time. In an era where women comprised about 4% of American physicians, she was pursuing a medical degree. And while she was quiet and studious, she also had views on sex that couldn't be reprinted in newspapers then, and would spare the Inquirer some outraged letters by not detailing them today. Instead, here's a sanitized view. Hicks was single and sexually active. On its own, that wasn't unusual for the 1920s. About half of the women enrolled in college at the time admitted in polls that they were sexually active. But Hicks was more experimental and open about her views than average. After a few weeks of flirtation, Snook and Hicks began a years-long affair. The professor even rented a room where the two could meet without raising suspicion. The gruesome discovery. Hicks shared a Columbus apartment with two roommates who were also sisters, Alice and Beatrice Buston. While Hicks didn't share much about their personal life, the sisters at least knew that she was supposed to come home after a date with an unnamed man, June 13, 1929. When she didn't show up, they weren't immediately worried. By the next afternoon, however, they were concerned enough to report a missing person to the police station. Soon after, two teenage boys happened upon what appeared to be an unbundled fabric in the weeds at the New York Central Railroad rifle range, where they had gone for target practice. As they drew closer, they realized the bundle was a body of a woman wearing a high-end brown dress and a white collar. They fetched police, who turned over the body to discover the woman's head had been crushed by what appeared to be a ball-peen hammer. Her throat had also been slit. Police at first zeroed in on past boyfriend of Hicks, a man named Marianne Myers, who had proposed marriage and been heartbroken when Hicks laughed at the request. Myers had an alibi and insisted he could never have inflicted the type of wounds Hicks endured. But he gave police important information, the name of another of Hicks' lovers, whose entanglement with a student would ignite a nationwide scandal. The confession. At first, Snook denied knowing Hicks beyond having met her through the Steino pool, but the police pressed and soon came more details. Snook admitted he had a 3-year affair with Hicks, who was then 24 when she died. Still, he maintained he had nothing to do with her death. Then a woman stepped forward who said she recognized Snook and Hicks from photos of them that ran in the newspapers. She had known them as a married couple who paid weekly for a room from her. Snook admitted to renting the room, but again said he had nothing to do with his lover's murder. That's when the prosecutor, John J. Chester Jr., did something that would endanger a conviction nowadays. He ignored Snook's pleas for his attorney and beat him, leaving red welts on each of his temples. Still, Snook did not confess. It was only after multiple beatings and upon learning that the Ohio State University had fired him for having an affair with a student that Snook signed a full confession. I took a very strong liking to the girl, but I do want it to be understood that ours was not a silly little love affair, Snook said. I still love my wife and baby and want to see them happy. Snook said the affair had begun as a frivolity but evolved into an obligation he resented. The night Hicks died, he told her that he planned an upcoming trip with his wife and baby. Hicks demanded that he cancel the trip, but he refused. He said that her reaction was startling. She screamed, "Damn you, I'll kill your wife and your baby. I'll kill you too." She'd reached for a purse in which Snook knew she sometimes kept a handgun he'd given her as a gift. He was sure she was about to shoot him, he said, so he grabbed a ball peen hammer inside his car and bashed her repeatedly in the head. As she staggered from the car, he realized she was too injured to survive, but yet still alive, so he said he took a pocket knife and slit her throat, taking care to cut both her jugular vein and carotid artery to ensure a quick death. The trial. Big-name reporters from the nation's top newspapers and wire services arrived in Columbus to cover the so-called trial of the century. Snook took the stand and described his sex liaisons in such detail that newspapers deemed the testimony unfit for print. The public clamored for those details, and a court stenographer knew a money-making opportunity when he saw one. He compiled the courtroom testimony for the trial in a softcover book and sold it at newsstands. Most copies were seized by angry protesters and police, but a few copies remain, including one at the UC campus. The jury in Snook's trial took less than half an hour to find the professor guilty of murder. He spent his last day alive with his wife, sharing with her his final meal of fried chicken, lamb chops, mashed potatoes, and ice cream. He was executed February 28th in 1930. This case was featured in Amber Hunt's book, Crimes of the Centuries, The Cases That Changed Us. Hunt is a host of the podcast Crimes of the Centuries and the co-founder of the Grab Bag Collab podcast network. And the final article we have for you today, Council Member Talks City New Density Plan. Sydney Franklin and Sharon Coolidge, Cincinnati Inquirer, USA Today Network. Cincinnati's controversial plan to update its 100-year-old zoning code may seem like it came out of nowhere, but the update, known as Connected Communities, has been years in the making and aims to tackle the city's ongoing housing shortage and affordability crisis. 2 years ago, a proposed ordinance to increase density via zoning changes failed after the public and most council members claimed it wasn't thorough enough and didn't include enough community engagement. The proposal also didn't touch single-family zoning, which makes up about 77% of the city's housing. Councilmember Reggie Harris, who back in 2022 failed ordinance, took the criticism as a learning experience. "It wasn't a perfect bill," he told the Inquirer. "That's So Cincinnati podcast." His experience working with the Community Builders Incorporated, an affordable housing developer, deepened his knowledge of how cities' current zoning code can restrict or delay the development. So he's trying again. Mayor Aftab Perel is also championing the legislation. The zoning change proposal is in the midst of the public feedback process and heads to the City Planning Commission on May 17th. If it passes, it could ready for council committee on June 4th. And if it passes the committee, a full council vote is expected the following day. If passed, it would be the first major amendment of the code in 20 years. Harris, Council Budget and Financial Committee Chairman, explained how his background led him to spearhead the proposal. He also broke down what the zoning changes really mean. A return to Cincinnati's very dense past. Right now, under the city's zoning code, it's illegal to build anything but a single-family home in most of the city. The plan removes barriers to building multifamily housing, which would expand housing choices, lower rents, and spur Cincinnati growth, Harris said. "It's really a return to Cincinnati's very dense past," Harris said. "All we're saying is this is just a part of the DNA of the city of Cincinnati, and we're just legalizing what is possible." But the plan doesn't call for adding density everywhere, as in 2022 the plan did. Instead, it would make it easier to build multifamily housing and mixed-use developments within a certain mile radius of neighborhood business districts and along transit corridors. Why? Creating more units and more foot traffic in commercial areas bolsters a neighborhood's economic vitality, Harris said. People fear more renters in their neighborhood. The biggest obstacle, according to public comment, is residents fear it would bring renters, not homeowners who care about the neighborhood. Census data shows 62% of Cincinnatians are renters, though the majority of people who attend connected community engagement sessions were homeowners. Harris said he is listening and understands. They're like, "Listen, if it ain't broke, don't fix it," he said. "Why are you coming over here meddling?" But, he said, connected communities is about long-term planning and making sure there is space for existing and future residents in every neighborhood. "Changing the zoning doesn't change the nature of a community overnight," he added. Why is this important is because when we look at cities like Nashville, Austin, Boulder, these growing cities, they're just starting to blow up and they didn't have a plan. For more on connected communities, follow City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge at Sharon Coolidge and development reporter Sydney Franklin at Sydney Franklin. And with that, that concludes hour one of the Sunday Cincinnati Inquirer for May 5th, 2024.